I will call to order the January 31st, 2017 meeting of the Pension Commission. The first item that we have this evening is the election of the 2017-2018 Commission officers. As has been tradition in the Minnesota legislature, that this office of chair rotates back and forth between the House and the Senate. The last 2 years, the House has had the chair, and that would mean that it would be going back to the Senate. And at this time, I would ask for nominations for chair. And having said that, I would like to put in nomination the name Julie Rosen, Senator Julie Rosen, for the chair. Are there any other nominations? Seeing none, all those in favor of Senator Rosen as chair, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? I'm done. Now you get to come over here, Senator Rosen.
Let me just have a moment to look around the room. This is wonderful to see you all. Welcome. It's our first meeting of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement, and it truly is an honor to be your chair. We're going to do some great work this year. I was just telling Representative Pearson that the commission is really, seriously and sincerely an honor to be on this commission because it stills your confidence that the legislative process does work in a very bipartisan manner. And we have always worked in a bipartisan manner on this commission. And I have worked with Representative Murphy and Senator Pappas for a very long time, and we've done some good work. And so I'm looking forward to doing that again with all of you. With that, I would like to start with introductions and just go around the room, if we could, before we pass the minutes and all that. Senator Pappas, would you please start and just tell us where you're from, how long you've been on the commission, and what your passions are?
You asked me a tough question. I'm not where I'm from. I'm from St. Paul, but how long I've been on the commission. As I recall, maybe 10 years. I was on, I believe, for 6 years, then 2 years as chair, then 2 years as vice chair with Representative O'Driscoll. So a long time, and for those of you who are new, I really invite you to be engaged, to learn about pension issues. It's really, really important. This is a very important job that we have. So I'm happy to be back on the commission.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Pappas. Senator Jasinski.
Good evening, everyone. Senator Jasinski, District 24, which is Faribault, Owatonna, Waseca, are the larger cities serving Dodge, Waseca, Steele, and Rice counties. I've been on the job for 28 days, a freshman senator. My other committees are vice chairman of transportation, on the Capital Investment Committee with Senator Senjum, on local government and state government. I was the mayor of Faribault for 8 years and involved in city government for 23 years, from city councils to planning commissions to economic development authorities. So I'm excited to be on this committee, and thank you.
Thank you.
Gary Dames, Senate District 16, which is Redwood County, Brown County, Lyon, Yellow Medicine, Lacapar, and part of Renville. And I'm brand new on the committee and look forward to working with you folks.
Dave Senjum from Rochester, representing, of course, Homestead and Dodge counties. Maybe not Dodge so likely, but that's the case. Been in the legislature. This is my 15th year. I became a pension committee member at 8:17 yesterday morning, vis-a-vis a phone call. But you know, we've all hung around pensions for a while, maybe indirectly, and as a city council member in Rochester, and more recently, of course, the last 15 years as a state legislator, I've always viewed pensions as a sacred trust between, if you will, in our case, state government and those that we serve through the pension process. So I look forward to meeting, or pardon me, being part of this committee, and as Senator Rosen said, do good work.
My name is Rachel Barth, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Pension Commission, and this will be my third legislative session with the commission.
My name is Susan Lencheski, and I am the executive director of the Pension Commission. I'm actually from Eden Prairie, and I've been involved with pension plans and 401k plans since 1988 as an attorney. I joined in August of 2015, started working in this position, and I'm very happy to be here.
My name is Lisa Dieslin. I'm the commission assistant, and I have been on the staff of the commission for 17 years and 1 month.
Representative Tim O'Driscoll, the past chair, as you saw, of the Pension Commission. This is my fifth year on pensions and my fourth term in the legislature, and I hail from the central Minnesota area.
Representative Sarah Anderson, I represent the area of Plymouth, Minnesota, and this is my second term on pensions.
Representative Bob Vogel, I live in Elko Newmarket and have Southern Scott and Western Lee Sore County in District 20A. And this is, I've been on the Pension Commission now about 1 day longer than Senator Sedum.
I'm Representative Roz Peterson, and I serve the areas of Burnsville, Lakeville, and I'm on my second term, but I'm new to this committee, and I'm looking forward to serving.
Paul Thiessen, Minneapolis, and I think this is my fifth non-consecutive term on the Pension Commission.
Senator Schoen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dan Schoen, been personally affected by what happens in this group for all of my working life, and I was almost afraid I wasn't going to get to hear any great speeches from Representative Mary Murphy. And they put me, one of the biggest guys in here, right by the post. So we should be fine.
And our very important staff, if you could please introduce yourself here at this table.
My name is Denise, I'm with Public Research.
Ryan Cook, Health and Public Research.
Jeremiah Woods, Health and Public Research.
Well, thank you very much and welcome. We, like Senator Pappas says, we have very important work to do here and very excited about it. So with that, we're going to go on to electing a vice chair. And Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I'd nominate Representative O'Driscoll.
Representative O'Driscoll has been nominated. Has there been any other nominations for vice chair? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator O'Driscoll, your vice chair. With that, we'll move on to secretary. Is there any nominations for secretary?
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
I would like to nominate Senator Pappas as the secretary to round out the executive committee for pensions.
Wonderful. Senator Pappas has been nominated as secretary for the Pension Commission. Any other nominations? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Pappas, thank you for serving secretary, and Representative O'Driscoll for serving as vice chair. With that, we need to approve the minutes from the May 17th, 2016 meeting. You've had a chance to take a look at those. If there's a motion to move those.
Madam Chair, I will move approval of the May 16, 2016 minutes.
Representative O'Driscoll moves the May 17th meeting minutes. Is there any comments, questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And then we will move on to the, we'll have a report from the State Board of Investment Executive Director, Minkus Perry, please. You can come. Mr. Perry, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Mansco Perry. I'm the Executive Director and Chief Investment Officer for the State Board of Investment. Before you, they're handing out a handout that I've got, and what I'll do is go through and give you some sense of what the State Board of Investment is, what we do, and try to give you some sense of how we go about determining our asset allocation and the associated projection of as a guideline of what return we would expect to make over the next 10-year period. So if you turn to page 2, you'll see that the State Board of Investment is defined in Article 11 of the Constitution, and the members of the State Board of Investment are the governor, the state auditor, the secretary of state, and the attorney general. The State Board of Investment, myself, are assisted by a 17-member investment advisory council, 10 members of the public who have knowledge in finance and investments serve as public members and are appointed by the board. We're pretty fortunate to have the chief investment officers of organizations like the Margaret A. Cargill Foundation, Target, 3M, Cargill Companies, and several other prominent organizations in the Twin Cities and throughout the state who sit as public members. Also, we have the three executive directors of the statewide pension organizations, TRA, MSRS, and PERA, sit as ex officio members, as does the Commissioner of Management and Budget, or his or her designee. I serve as executive director and have a staff of about 26 people on our staff. If you turn to the next page, you'll see the funds that we are responsible for at the State Board. In addition to the pension assets, which represent a bit more than 70% of the assets we're responsible for, we also manage a supplemental investment account, which serves as the primary pension vehicle for unclassified employees and is used by volunteer and other fighter organizations throughout the state, and also within our deferred compensation program. We also have a deferred compensation program, which is, I believe, the fifth largest in the nation. In addition to that, we are responsible for managing the state cash accounts, which include the general funds, the second largest pool of monies that we manage, and also a series of non-retirement accounts. We don't administrate, but we manage the assets for the likes of the Permanent School Fund, the Environmental Trust Fund, the Closed Landfill Funds, and other entities. So most people have a question, what is the State Board of Investment? As I said before, we're established by the Constitution. We're not the pension plan, and we're not a sponsoring entity. Our charge is to manage state pension and other state investment assets. We have limited capability of managing or administering funds, so we generally do that through other organizations, primarily the pension funds. We are simply there to manage the investments. Chapter 11A is our governing statute, and in Chapter 11A 24, you'll be able to see what we have the authority to invest in. And we're also governed by the fiduciary and standard of care sections of Chapter 356A. As I said before, in addition to the pension assets, there are a myriad of other things that we manage, and you'll see those in the next two pages. Yes. believe that most of what people are here to hear about tonight are the pension plans. So if you turn to page 6, you'll see that we manage the combined pension fund assets of the three statewide pension plans. We invest those assets primarily through outside investment managers like J.P. Morgan, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs. My staff is responsible for doing the sourcing and due diligencing and recommending to our investment advisory council and ultimately the board, the managers that we hire to manage the pension assets. We provide the ongoing monitoring responsibility, and eventually we end up making also the recommendations to terminate managers. If you turn to page 7, you'll get a sense of what our strategic asset allocation is. In other words, the type of assets that we currently manage within the pension plans. The largest segment are public equities, which are international and domestic stocks. We own most stocks, most public stocks in the United States, as well as a large segment of the public stocks available around the world. And that represents about almost, a little more than 60% of the assets in the pension plans. We also have about a 20% allocation to U.S. bonds. There we have treasuries, corporate bonds, mortgages, and other high-yield bonds and other bonds that are available within the U.S. and some, not many, non-U.S. bonds. One of the most important pieces of the portfolio is our alternative investment portfolio. We have a target of 20%. We probably have about 13% of that actually invested today. And what you'll find there are we invest in private equity managers, oil and gas resource managers, real estate, and private debt fund managers. If you turn to the next page, you'll see we have two long-term objectives, which we've been pretty fortunate to consistently exceed. Our first is to, over a 10-year period, to have the funds exceed a composite index, which is simply a passive representation of the type of assets that we invest in. And we've been pretty fortunate that for a long series of years, we've been able to meet that 10-year objective. The other long-term objective is to provide a real return over a 20-year period. We've also been consistently able to meet that objective. So that would be what we earn in excess of inflation. If you turn to page 9, I'll give you a glimpse of what our recent performance has been. You'll see on the left-hand side of the page what our performance has been relative to our composite index for the past 5 years. And on the right side of the page, you'll see our longer-term results. You'll notice that for the last 30 years, we've been able to generate an annualized return of 8.7% versus a composite slightly less than that. If you turn to the next page, you'll see a, kind of a comparison of where we stand versus a comparison group of all public funds above $1 billion. We generally have found ourselves to be in the upper half of the first half. Once in a while, as in this past year, we did slip below, but saw the numbers today, and we're back in the first quartile for this fiscal year. So that should give you a glimpse of who we are and what we do. The next half of what I've got to present is...
Mr. Perry?
Yes.
Is there any questions from the members on this first half? Okay, with that, thank you, Mr. Perry. Okay.
Madam Chair? So what I'm going to do here is try to give you some semblance of how our asset allocation is formulated and the guideposts for what we believe that will allow us to earn over the next 10 years. I caution everyone to recognize that we come up with a number. It's a guess, and I'm going to try to explain to you why it's an estimate, how they come about it, and that what it really represents is a range of outcomes over time periods. So if you look at page 11, the slide we've got there, so this is just a hypothetical example that I try to use. You'll see that the median return in this example is 10%, and we get there by having a combination of stock and bonds. I think that it's 75% stock, 75% bonds. You'll see in the southwest corner the projected annual return, and most importantly, the risk level associated with stocks and bonds in this example. So what you'll see here is that with this mix of stocks and bonds in a one-year period, while there's a mean of 10%, we would expect in any one-year period to maybe earn as much as 35, 36%, but potentially lose as much as 16%. Everyone generally focuses on that median number, but our expectation is given what we've gotten, given the risk associated with the assets that we're investing in, or with these two assets, that's what would happen. As we go further to the east side of the page, we'll see that for 3 years, there's a little bit more convergence. We would expect that there'd be convergence more to the mean, but we would still expect over that three-year period that we can earn 2.5 times what the mean is, but still also potentially lose money. For a five-year period, there's more convergence. And then over that 10-year period, while we would expect that that 10-year time period, there'd be an expectation of a 10% median return, we would expect that there would be a range of outcomes that could happen, 20% to a little less than zero. So that kind of gives you a framework of how this is all put together. Next, I'll jump to how well we believe we performed over the last 20%, last 20 years. So if you look, what the red line signifies is what the 8.5% discount rate, we've used that as a target. But what you'll see there is we've been pretty successful over the last 20 years in exceeding that. But you'll note that we've never actually in any given year had an 8.5% return. We have had a few years below it, and we've actually had, fortunately, very few years where we've had a negative return. So what I'm going to go through now is kind of an example. We recently, this past fiscal year, worked with our consultant, and we reviewed our asset allocation, and going through that process, we did make some minor changes to our asset allocation, but trying to give you the extent of what we go through when we come up with these numbers. So what you'll see on this page is our consultant's best estimate of what different asset classes will make, what different types of stocks and bonds will make, as well as other type of alternative assets that we could invest in. And what you should focus on are the first three columns, the projected return. And what you'll see there, again, in any given year, it looks as though we can generate some pretty nice returns. But over a 10-year period, that gets smaller because what we're looking at is incorporating not only into the returns is the level of risk that's associated with each of these asset classes. So that one-year return is what's known as an arithmetic return. What we try to focus on more is that longer-term geometric return, which also takes into consideration the level of risk associated, and you'll see that in every case it's a smaller number. And so that's the that second column is what we're generally focusing on. And as you'll see, over the next 10 years, what we're looking at is that for public equities of a variety of sorts that we would anticipate, if everything goes as their model suggests, that public equities will earn somewhere between 7 and 8 percentage points. The bigger problem we got are bonds. And we've had a lot of people ask us, why are you in this current interest rate environment, are you investing in bonds? I think that bonds are a very important part of having a diversified portfolio because they're kind of our anchor to windward. Everyone remembers 8 years ago when the stock market declined precipitously. I think at one point we were down over 50%. At that time, many organizations, the SBI included, were able to rebalance out of bonds into stocks and were able to then take advantage of almost 300% increase that the equity markets have experienced since that low point in time. So, I mean, I'm a big believer that bonds are an extremely important part of a diversified portfolio. You'll also see in the bottom third of the page the alternative investments. They're, depending upon the type of investments you'll have, they're also all over the map. But also, some of the asset classes are also have some of the higher standard deviations, which is the level of risk associated with those assets. If you turn to the next page, you'll see that the next and just as important ingredient in coming up with all of this is we look at the correlation of how these assets work together. And what a correlation does is, I was once given the example that if you had two lines moving like this, they're highly correlated. It's when you've got two lines going like this that they're uncorrelated. And that's what we attempt to do is we try to put together a portfolio of assets and also within the assets, the type of managers we use. We try to find managers that aren't very correlated together, and that's how we get what I learned in business school in Chicago that is a free lunch, diversification. What you want to have is a diversified portfolio because if everything went the same way, all the times, when you did have a drawdown or a large drop in markets, and if they all happened at the same time, you'd have a very difficult chance of recovering. And what you want to do is to have a variety of assets that are interacting with one another that, in the best circumstances, give you a smooth line of performance. But I doubt that you'll be able to pick up any graph and see a smooth line of performance. Hopefully they're going from southwest to northeast, but rarely will you see one that just goes in a straight line. But they're going to be choppy, and that's what we're trying to capture here. And what we're hoping to be able to do is to put together a pretty diversified portfolio so that it gets to be as close to a straight line as possible, and again, going to the northeast quadrant. So if you'll turn to the next page, what you'll see here is where we started with our portfolio. Under the first column, which is labeled policy, that represents the target portfolio that we've had for the past 5, 6, 7 years at the SBI. In that portfolio, we've had a mix of public equities of about 60%, 18% in fixed income, a target of 20% with private market vehicles, and 2% in cash. Given the level of where the market is and what we believe we need to make, we have always been and probably will continue to be pretty equity-oriented. And we looked at ways in which we could change the portfolio. All we really looked at were little tweaks we could make. We believe that we've pretty much the last 20 years, we've had a bias towards more U.S. Domestic equities than international. We thought that maybe we should lessen that bias a little bit. And also, we thought that we should probably have a little bit more exposure to bonds than we have had, again, having that anchor to windward. And so what we did was play with a few different mixes. And what we settled on is mix number four. And mix number four, you'll see there that what we did was this, we had a simple trade-off of equities of 2%. We dropped equities by 2%, raised bonds by 2% from our policy. One thing that doesn't show up here is the 20% in alternative investments. To the extent that we aren't at our target, we never have been. If I manage the portfolio correctly, we never will. As we approach it, I probably will go back to the board and ask for an increase in it, because what we want to do is to make sure that we have a continuing program. If I were to reach the 20% target, then the program stops, and there also might be a call to disband the program. Obviously, if we had a major drawdown, we'd have what's known as a denominator effect, and we'd probably excuse ourselves from that and hopefully wait for time to pass by. But this is the asset allocation that we ultimately arrived at. So with that 20% target, we're never there. So in the past 7 or 8 years, to the extent that we weren't at our target, there's the differential between our actual portfolio and that target was invested in bonds, giving us a slightly lower return than projected. We changed that, and going forward, at least until we do our next asset allocation, those dollars, which right now represents about 7% of the portfolio, will be invested in equities, and we think that that'll be a little bit accretive to the numbers that you see here. So what we ended up, if you look at the compounded expected return, that's the 10-year geometric return that our new asset allocation has as a guidepost, is what we might expect to earn with this asset allocation over a 10-year period. I would anticipate that we'll get a little bit more because of the playoff with the alternative investments, but that number is 7.3. You'll remember in the past we had a number that was in excess of 8. This is where we believe it is now. Again, the SBI doesn't forecast these numbers, but we do work with our consultants. And the caveat that I always give is that it's the best guess based on what everyone does on those previous two pages. And what you'll notice, and I'll take a bet with anyone that over the next 10 years that the numbers will be different than this 7.3, but what you'll notice in the industry that there's been a lot of convergence with a lot of plans. The numbers have fallen. We've recognized that decrease a little bit slower than others. And while I still believe there's an opportunity for us to make something higher than this, we stand by the asset allocation and believe that this is probably the best guidepost for us. I know that you'll have some discussions going forward with regards to what the actuarial discount rate should be. I would say this should be not the rate, but just one of the factors that you take into consideration in coming up with the rate. I've been trying quite a bit to get people to recognize that what I believe we can make on the asset side is different than what the discount rate should be. One of the concerns I've got is that 6 years ago, we had an actuarial rate of 8.5%. I think we may have been a little bit slower than others in reducing that rate, but going from 8.5 to 7.5, while I would believe that that's where we should be headed. That's a pretty significant drop in a six-year period. It seems like only one percentage point, but that's about a 16 or 17% drop in that rate. I just think everyone needs to have in mind. One of the things that I've been talking to people about is, while I believe that this is an important part of what's needed to come at in developing a rate, I think just as importantly, we need to find a better way to react. Because if markets behave as they have been this fiscal year and they go up, the one thing I'm pretty certain that will happen is all the guesses that consultants and asset managers make will start to see that number, after going down for the last decade, start to go up. The number does bounce around. It will bounce around. I just think we need to come up with a better method of how we use that number, or how the actuaries use that number in coming up with their recommendation for you on what the discount rate should be. The remainder of the presentation simply gives examples of the meaning of what I just went through, but I won't go through those. They're just going to give more of a highlight, pointing out that, once again, there is a range around that median number. So if anyone has any questions, I'll try to answer them. Hopefully I haven't completely confused everybody. I joke that I'll use Stingalese to Susan to kind of explain that, you know, these concepts aren't as complex as we make them out to be. But I hope I've been able to put them into some pretty simple terms so that everyone has some sense of what we do.
I've been on the Pension Commission for about 8 years, and it's just starting to get solidified. Still feel like I'm hanging on. But we are, to that point, we are going to recess after Commissioner France's testimony or presentation and have Pensions 101. And there's pizza back there, too. But there are some questions. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, I'm not sure I quite understand that. So we work with...
You said we have to influence the word escaped me. It starts with an A.
Actuaries? The actuary.
Yeah, the actuary. Well,
yeah.
I've had a mask. The interim took those words out of my mouth.
Well, I believe that the information that I give you is pretty important, but I believe it's only one perspective, one viewpoint that people ought to try to understand it. So on the asset side, we use it as a guideline. As I've tried to explain, it's the best guess. I'm willing to take all bets right now that this number is wrong. Unfortunately, I don't believe that on the liability side that it should be taken lightly. And I think the actuaries, again, this is one bit of information for them. I do get a little bit concerned when they say that, well, we're going to wait to hear what you say, and that's the number.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And then when we have other questions about this last part of the thing, before we go on to the agenda, could we do page 8 and 9 again?
Mr. Perry.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy. So what page 8 is, we have two long-term objectives for the combined pension funds, or you know, the assets for them. And what we do in the first one is it's just a measurement of how well we've done versus what essentially is a passive representation of what we invest in. And we've been pretty fortunate in my entire association with the State Board of Investment of being able to exceed that 10-year measure. So what that exemplifies is for the last 10 years, we've been able to add 20 basis points to our composite index, which is the benchmark barometer for our total portfolio. The second part of the page shows that we've been able to add over 500 basis points. The portfolio has added over 500 basis points over inflation over a 20-year period. So the objective is for us to provide 300 to 500 basis points over inflation, and we've been able to do that. On page 9, what we have here is an example of our recent and longer-term performance. So you can see in fiscal year 16, it wasn't one of our better years. We were about at zero. I believe that if we had done a better job with our managers, we might have made 1%, but we underperformed. But in the prior year, we outperformed what the market had to give by 40 basis points. So you can look at that combined funds as basically, we don't know what the market's going to give, but that represents what's available in the market. And we believe that our job is to try to make at least what's available in the market and then add some to that. So you can see on the right-hand side, these are longer-term numbers. And we like to point to the fact that over the longer term, we've been pretty successful. But if you look at the 3, 5-year, and 10-year numbers, you'll see that we have been in a low environment period, most of which came about with the Great Recession of 2008-2009. In 3 years, I'm going to be excited to look at the numbers because they'll go off. So if we just make 8% the next 2 years, that huge 18% drop is going to go off, and we'll have a big bump in the number from year to year.
Representative Thank you, Murphy.
Great. Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Perry, in the investment consultants that you work with on SBI, have you talked at all with them, about what they are anticipating inflation to be over the next 5, 10, 15 years? Is that something that they share with you? And if so, could you maybe speak to us a little bit about what you see or have heard from the experts?
Mr. Perry.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll. In our asset allocation, our consultant used inflation at 2.25%. We've had a lot of discussion about that because, again, what we've used in prior asset allocations was a higher number. I believe that the 2.25% is directionally correct for what we're doing. One, given the environment we're currently in and we have been in, for the last, I've got numbers here somewhere, but I think for the last 20 years, inflation has averaged on the order of 2%. I would anticipate if interest rates go up, one of the components there is that inflation might go up, but I'm hoping that if it does go up, it will go up as slowly as it came down. A big shock will be some bad news, but if it goes up slowly, I mean, part of what inflation indicates is that there's growth in the economy, which is what we want. That's what we're trying to capture here. But a shock to the system causes a little bit more anxiety than I would care to explain the next year when I came here. So.
Representative Murphy. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Perry, you have hit on my next question, and that is, as interest rates go up, the Fed has started to telegraph to the markets that it feels that its next direction is up. It has done that in the last 15 months in raising interest rates. How does that affect the portfolio, the mix number four, option number four that you've spoken about? If rates were to go up, does that affect the rate of return of that 7.3 that you were looking at?
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, as I mentioned before, it depends. It will have an impact. It depends upon the rate at which it goes up. If it goes up quickly, it won't necessarily be a signal that the economy is growing. It'll be a shock to the system. So if it goes up gradually, it's going to have an impact. It will most definitely have an impact on bonds. As interest rates go up, the current value of bonds go down, depending upon how you... We have essentially the broad market. If we manage them differently, we could insulate ourselves from some of the shock. But given the way that our bonds are currently managed, we would have an adverse impact, but the magnitude of that impact would depend upon the rate at which it goes up. One of the things that our bond managers would be doing if rates went up rather slowly would be reconfiguring the mix and anticipating the rise. But so it's really a function of how the interest rates behave.
Any further questions? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is on page 14, and that is the methodology and assumptions for the correlation matrix. And I was just wondering if you could maybe delve into, I guess, what variation or the mean variance optimization is ideal.
Mr. Perry.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, I didn't hear the last part of the question.
Maybe just explain what this chart means and what you see as a portfolio. I presume it's to determine what kind of mix you have in your portfolio. And so with all the numbers, the deviation model in there, what is the optimum number that you're looking for? Okay.
Mr. Perry.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson. This is the matrix that's used in conjunction with the prior page and the assets that we use. So what would happen, I should have put in an abbreviated page as well, but what this essentially does is go through the mix, and the results are really encapsulated in the next page and what the outcomes would do. So what page 14 is showing us is what's the correlation between the different asset classes. We don't use all of these asset classes. Most we can consider. Some are not in our statutes, and we're not able to consider. But we go through a process called mean variance optimization. It's one way of doing an asset allocation. And what it takes into consideration are the projected return, projected standard deviation, and the correlation amongst the assets that we're going to consider. And it'll go through a stochastic process, essentially a Monte Carlo simulation, and it will go through. But the biggest driver, I believe, in these returns are the standard deviation or the risk associated with the assets. That's what causes them to go up and down. And the results of our process are what you see on page 15. So what it came out with for us is using mix number four. What you see at the top is the target asset allocation that we'll use. But what it says is that if you remember the chart I showed at the beginning of the second half, is that the arithmetic return, or return in any one given year, the median of that would be 8.57. But for that 10-year period, what it shows is that the geometric return that would be expected over that 10-year period would be the 7.3 with a standard deviation portfolio of 1744. And simply, if you look at the bottom, the 5822, it kind of gives you a mix of public equities and bonds or cash. It's excluding the 20% alternative investments are there. But I'm not sure if that answers the question. But
further questions? Well, Mr. Perry, thank you very much for coming forward, and glad to see you're at the helm. Appreciate your work. Thank you very much.
Hopefully this was helpful. Thank you.
It was very helpful. With that, we are going to have Commissioner Myron Franz come up, and there is a handout that's being passed out right now, and he's going to be talking about the Blue Ribbon Panel. Welcome, Commissioner. Good to see you again.
Madam Chair, yeah, I believe this morning I saw you in the Finance Committee, so it's good to see you again, Matt. Congratulations, Madam Chair, and congratulations, Vice Chair, and congratulations, Secretary, and all of you for being on the Pension Commission. This is a great committee, a commission to be on, and I appreciate the invitation to come here and explain the Governor's Blue Ribbon Panel. So what I would like to do is get into it right away and go through the and set up just briefly what the panel was looking at in terms of the situation and the timing in terms of what we're trying to do for the Governor. I think if we go to page 4 on the handout, the impact, I mean, one of the things you're going to hear more about in the 101 is obviously the Minnesota public pension plans and their far-reaching effect in Minnesota. The Minnesota State Retirement System, the Teachers Retirement Association, the Public Employees Retirement Association, and St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association cover public school teachers, police officers, firefighters, state patrol, and correctional employees, and other state and local government employees, over 530,000 active and deferred members across these four systems.
Commissioner, before you get into the weeds here, could you just explain to the commission how this came about, who was on the panel, and the length of work, when you started? Because I really do think that sets up the work that you have done, and it's very important.
I think if you would go to the to slide number 10, would set up sort of the situation that the panel that the Governor that we put together was comprised of business, some legal, academic, and financial professionals who came together in November and December of 2015 to review the status of the pension plans. And what had happened, the pension plans, who have done a great job, put together some proposals. And what the Governor asked was for some help in deciding whether or not to include pension reform in his budget. So we were operating under a tight time frame, and we had to finish the Blue Ribbon Panel by December of this last year in order to provide those recommendations to the Governor, in order for him to consider whether he could include those any recommendations in his budget proposal. So if you look on page 11 of the handout, you can see the Blue Ribbon Panel members. The panel was selected to be from across the state, and the idea was to provide with as many different points of view as we could find in a short period of time. And I can tell you that this panel operated very efficiently, and there was not a single expenditure made on behalf of the state. These people all volunteered and provided the resources to the governor. We had Professor Colleen Manchester from the Carlson School of Management, Tom Borman, an attorney in Minneapolis, David Crosby, a managing director at Piper Jaffray, James Campbell, retired president and CEO of Wells Fargo, Brenda Brandon, the chief wealth management officer at the North Shore Bank of the Commerce in Duluth, Minnesota, Samuel Kaplan, the former ambassador and attorney in Minneapolis, and Maury Lanning, the former Minnesota a former representative and former chair of this legislative commission on pensions and retirements. What we asked these folks to do was to come together and look at the presentations and the proposals that the different plans had put together and to review from their situation What were the most important things that they could recommend to the governor? How could they convince the governor that, yes, this was not only an important area, but it's something that he should put into his budget? And if you look on page 12, you can see the findings of the panel. And the panel had an opportunity to meet with the pension plans. They had an opportunity to review different information that we put together about pensions around the country and the funding of the Minnesota pension plans. And what they were able to come up with was they understood that the Minnesota pension plans are currently underfunded in the sense that we have an unfunded liability, and that unfunded liability is likely to grow in the future if we don't make some adjustments to the contribution levels, both by employees and employers. So one of the things that the Pension Commission did, or I'm sorry, the Blue Ribbon panel did, was to review that status of the pension funds. They found that the pension funds are currently underfunded. They also found, as we heard from Executive Director Mansco Perry, they also found that the assumed rate of return, or the discount rate that was being used, and statutorily it's one and the same, at 8% was too high. Given the information available, the panel recommended that the current rate should be reduced to 7.5%. And as Mansco Perry mentioned earlier, you know, making these changes does make significant changes in the unfunded liability of the plans. But nonetheless, it was the panel's recommendation that a 7.5% investment return was more accurate, or at least more accurately reflected the potential unfunded liability of the plans. The other thing that they found was that the pension plan really needs to be funded adequately going forward. That is in the best interest of the state of Minnesota. One of the things that we noted was there are 185,000 Minnesotans across the state who receive over $3 billion a year in pension payments from the various funds. Clearly, we have a number of Minnesotans depending upon this pension, these pension plans, and it provides really a sound economic benefit to the entire state. The last finding that they made was that that we need to act now. One of the question marks for the governor was how quickly do we need to move on these underfunded problems in terms of the contribution levels or the cost of living adjustments, and the panel concluded that inaction would only exacerbate the current problem, that the Minnesota taxpayers need to understand and that these funds are being supported sufficiently both by the employer and by the employee. So their recommendations are included on slide 13. And the panel recommended that they support the investment and return and discount rate assumption at 7.5%. They supported changes to improving plan funding by increased contributions, and they really supported the idea of shared sacrifice, where the employees, the employer, and the retirees all share in making contributions to reducing the unfunded liability. They also support more funding at the state level, and they recommended to the governor that he include in his budget, which he did, a significant contribution to reducing the unfunded liability. And they also supported some reform strategies to mitigate pension risk. And I've talked to several of you about the need to engage in reforms going forward, not just to solve the immediate, I guess I shouldn't say solve. You never solve this problem once and for all. You need to adjust it periodically. But in addition to making the changes to reduce the unfunded liability now, the panel recommended that we engage in some reform ideas to figure better ways to make sure that we manage the contribution levels in the future and the COLA levels in the future so that we keep these funds in adequate support. A copy of the full report, I think, has been passed out or is available to people in the audience, or it's certainly been made available to the commission. So that was really how the panel came together. We operated in October, November, and December, made the recommendations to the governor. The governor, as you know, on January 24th, did include over $100 million in support for funding the contributions going forward, and I hope at a later time I'll be able to come to the commission and explain the governor's recommendations. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair, Commissioner, did the panel talk about, like, 7.75? Instead of 7.5?
Commissioner France.
Madam Chair, Representative, the panel looked at a range of options available, and I think one of the remember, this was, we were operating in a pretty tight time frame, and we couldn't ask these folks to spend too much time on this. Their view of the correct number was that it needed to be lowered. And we weren't sure of the right number, but based on the recommendations that we could get from the plans and other folks in the industry, we felt that 7.5 was the right start. Certainly part of the reform that we would recommend going forward is that we look to study what is the right number, how do we adjust it at different times going forward. As Mr. Perry mentioned, this number is going to move over time. But there was no discussion other than concluding that 7.5% was the best move to make at this time.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Franz, a couple questions for you. On the summary page on 13, how did the group come to this list? Did they have a final meeting and they all voted on and agreed to that this was going to be it? Can you maybe talk about the methodology that when you said this is what the group recommended?
Madam Chair and Representative, we spent, I don't forget how many meetings we had. We had some phone calls. We had some meetings. And at the end, we sort of put to the panel members, what are your primary goals? What do you see of those areas where you can agree on that they felt comfortable with? Remember, we were dealing with citizens, volunteers here who did not have a lot of a professional. They weren't actuaries or they weren't plan professionals. So they wanted to keep the recommendations broad or broadly focused. And it was through the final meeting we came up with a set of recommendations that they all felt comfortable with. It wasn't a vote per se, but everybody agreed with the movement that we had. Former Representative Moore Lanning was one of the advisors or members of the group and was also trying to make sure people understood what would help the governor and what would help this commission. I mean, the goal really was to make sure that the policy advisors, in this case the governor, about putting in this recommendation to his budget, but also the policy advisors at this table, what would be most helpful for you all?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, to the issue of reforms, how deep did the Blue Ribbon panel, I realize it was only maybe assembled for 90 days, but did they have any discussion as to thoughts for recommendations or at least conversation about what some of those reforms might be?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, they did, but to be fair, I couldn't recall any group consensus. There were different views tossed around about going forward in terms of monitoring the return after doing something more reform-minded if your returns come in excess of what you might get in a particular year rather than just changing contribution levels, maybe doing something with discount rates. But these were just general discussions, and there was no real agreement on particular reforms. But there was a general consensus that we hoped that the commission would take it upon themselves to really dive into to doing some things that would make the system work even more effectively going forward.
And to that point, Representative O'Driscoll and members, Ms. Barth has done that work, and there will be a report coming out fairly shortly. I'm not sure if we will get to it next week. We have a pretty full agenda next week, but that report will be available to you all very soon. So she has done a lot of work on that in the interim, on the reform piece. Yes, Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My last question, Commissioner, is the governor's plan to continue to keep the Blue Ribbon Commission in place to look at things that the Pension Commission might be doing or to offer some ideas on reform strategies that the commission could consider, that looking at the list of the people that you have, many of them have some private sector experience and maybe some different ideas of ways that they have worked with compensation and different things in the past. Just curious to know the scoping of what you're looking at.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, I had to promise that they would be done in December, but but I do know that
promises can be broken.
I know that a lot of them were very interested and I think would be more than willing and would love to continue that involvement. I just haven't had the nerve to go back and ask them yet.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. Commissioner, when I say promises can be broken, I certainly don't want that to be telegraphed today, that I think pension promises should be broken to the members who are here today. What I'm talking about is somebody who has an interest in that. When you tell them that they're done, that promise can be broken to bring them back to help with a greater cause. So,
thank you. I understand. Thank you.
Well, I do want to
commend the governor for pulling this panel together and you, Commissioner, for pulling this panel together. I think it's very important. I don't know if we've ever had a panel such as this in the Pension Commission, and it's extremely important to have that branch of government at the table along with what the good work that we do around this table here. So thank you very much for instigating it, that and a wonderful group of people that was put together. So look forward to implementing that, looking forward to the reforms that are going to be present with that. Any other further questions for the commissioner? Before we recess, and there is pizza back there for our Pensions 101, so all the members can, you members stay, but anybody else is free to go. Next week, we are going to have the commissioner back, and he'll do the governor's budget review for pensions. We also are going to, we're going to review and pass out the 2016 omnibus pension bill, minus the controversial COLA for the DRA, and get that moving, and then we have a few other things. We may have time for some reform issues, but for that. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. Just a question on the, and we'll get into it more next year, but I know that the governor put a bunch of many of the pension increases for MSRS and PARA in each individual agency, which is, I don't think, been done before.
Right.
So how is the Pension Commission going to deal with that, and how are committees going to deal with that? Is there going to be a uniform rule that committees have to do it or not? Because if we could have, you know, the state government committees coming in with no pension increases. We could have the Education Committee coming in, including the Pension Commission or the increases for pensions, and we could be all over the board. And as a Pension Commission, how are we going to know how much money we can spend in terms of passing out what we're going to pass out? Have you all given any thought to how you're going to deal with that issue?
No. Representative Thiessen, we have talked about that because that, and I do think it's refreshing that those costs are reflected in the appropriate division. But if that's a discussion, we can continue next week after we have a chance to huddle and get your opinion about that. That I think that's appropriate. Okay, super. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank
appreciate
you
all. That. With that, we are in recess. So, members, there's pizza and stuff, and if you want to do Pensions 101, and Deloitte is here, and we all also with our fine staff will be here to talk about that.
Let's do our part before Deloitte. I'm not sure I want to sit for Deloitte.